Hey there, you're listening to Unlimited Hangout. I'm your host, Whitney Webb. Today, we are going to be talking about speech and how the concept of free speech is changing rapidly, not just in the United States, but elsewhere, particularly in the West. Increasingly, in the countries that have long claimed to champion democracy and the freedom to say what you wish, speech is becoming likened to terrorism, and those that speak the wrong words could soon find themselves labeled as terrorists for doing so. As I've noted in past articles and also in a more recent speech, the Biden administration's policy documents for the so-called war on domestic terror call for the censorship of, quote, polarizing voices, voices that disagree with the state's narrative and thus foment disagreement and allegedly incite violence. Such speech, if this agenda is allowed to advance further, will label those polarizing figures terrorists, merely because what they say might persuade people from distrusting the government. There are precedents for what follows the implementation of such policies, though not so much in the West in recent history. It's not hard to see what the criminalization of dissent leads to and what kind of government makes that criminalization a state policy. To discuss the state of speech in the West today, I am joined by Gareth Eich, a journalist, activist, and musician who is all too familiar with the themes of censorship and how this particular agenda has been a steady, if gradual, march over the course of the past several years and even decades. Gareth and his family, particularly his father, David Eich, have been on the front lines of the censorship agenda much longer than most people. Very recently, David Eich was banned from visiting several European countries after the Dutch government made that decision after consultations with police and counterterrorism officials. Has the line between inconvenient speech and terrorism allegations begun to disappear entirely? We'll be getting into this question and much more in today's podcast. So, hey, Gareth, thanks for being here and welcome to Unlimited Hangout.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So I guess it goes without saying that the hot topic today is how your father has been banned from much of Europe. So what exactly happened and what was the role, as far as you know, of counter-terror officials in reaching that decision?
It was crazy. So basically, Dad was asked to speak at a peace rally, an anti-war rally in Amsterdam. And as soon as he was asked, he said, yeah, that sounds great. Like, I'd love to do that. And then the Dutch media jumped on that. There's a couple of complaints from organizations that have kind of gone for my dad before, that, you know, the usual suspects that all have ties to Israel, just saying, you know, anti-Semite. They never give any evidence of it, of course. They just kind of shout it, and it tends to stick when it comes to the media. So the media went on the absolute rampage with it, and it was like it was front page news for like 2 weeks. It was, you know, it was leading bulletins on mainstream news shows. It was crazy, really. They had all these people in. They had police officers, head of police, the mayor. They had politicians in there all talking about it. Never asked my dad, obviously, for his point of view. But then it got to a point in the end where they were interviewing two police chiefs, and one of them said on this show that actually, well, we can't ban him because, you know, he's not done anything wrong. Like, he's not, like, as in, he doesn't have a criminal record. He's not breaking the law. So, you know, I guess basically we can't stop him coming here. We can't stop him talking. Obviously, if he gets up there and starts preaching hate, you know, which obviously he's never going to do, but if he did, they could react at that point, obviously, and try and, you know, shut it down or whatever, but they can't stop him. You know, you can't do a whole minority report thing on it and kind of pre-crime it, you know. To which the journalist, for want of a better phrase, said, is there not a loophole you can find? Which is amazing to me because, you know, if free speech goes, journalists are the ones that are going to feel it, you know, so it just seemed like such a lack of foresight.
Well, not in today's world, right, where most journalists are, you know, extensions of the state.
Well, yeah, I
guess.
More
often than not.
Fair point, yeah. But you know, that was how it was going. And then, but he was still traveling there. He was still going to do it. And so he sent me a picture from him, like, driving down to the South Coast to get into the Channel Tunnel to post on his Instagram. So I posted that. And then I went out for a run, like a 10-minute guilt run because I've eaten too much. And for some bizarre reason, I don't know why, you know, I just thought, I'll just check. I don't have anything to do quickly. Because like you said at the top, I'm like crazy busy all the time. So I'll just check. I've actually got 10 minutes free. And at that point, I'd received an email from the Dutch government with two PDFs in it, both in Dutch, which obviously, you know, I'm English. So I'm obnoxious and I don't know foreign languages. So I forwarded them over to my dad and to his friend Christiana, who's Dutch. And then, you know, just said, I've just had this from the government. I don't know what it means, but there you go. And then I went for my run. And when I came back, I had a message from her saying, like, oh, my goodness me, this is insane. Like, he's banned from Holland. He's banned from the EU, which is like 26 countries. And then the second PDF was citing the current terror levels in Holland as a reason for his banning. And the terror levels are set to level 3, which is that there is a very real threat. And so with him coming, that's a very real threat. And I was like, we are in the twilight zone now. This is madness. So it was quite funny. So then I just tweeted about it, you know, like this is what we've just found. And obviously got the usual kind of Ukraine flag in bios all celebrating it. And then I was contacted by a few people from the press in Holland that obviously had no interest in talking to us before this happened, basically saying, oh, no, that's not what it says. That's not what it says. And then a Dutch politician was interviewed and they said, no, it was done. It was done for his benefit. Like it was to protect him. He was in danger. I'm thinking, right, okay.
Really?
And so it was a bit of a backpedal. But what they didn't do is they didn't tell the prime minister that that was their – that that's what they were going to say. So he was asked about it at COP28, whatever it's called, the climate conference. And like I say, he wasn't given the brief that they were pretending it was for my dad's own benefit. So he goes on this tangent about how he's banned because we don't want him in our country and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, well,
yeah, that he's a conspiracy theorist, right? That was that we don't have conspiracy theorists in our country or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, exactly. So it went against the backpedal because I don't think they, Whitney, I don't think they expected people to kick off. I mean, like I say, a few people on Twitter celebrated it, you know, the usual suspects. But most people, very much the same as with the Alex Jones thing, were kind of like, I remember when, you know, it was $1 billion for Alex Jones. And I saw lots of, I don't like Alex Jones, but I can't stand Alex Jones, but because of the level of it, you know. And that was the same with my dad. The amount of times I was looking through Twitter, which is a bit of a cesspit, to be fair, but I was looking through. And there was lots of, you know, oh, my God, I can't stand that nutter. But, like, you know, because this is insane. I mean, you're banning a guy from the European Union, someone who's never committed a crime, never even been investigated for a crime, never been arrested for anything in his life. He's a 70-odd-year-old bloke, you know. And so it kind of backfired on them a bit. And so then they went on the defense. Oh, no, you know, no, it wasn't for that. That's not the reason, because they realized that public opinion was kind of going against them in Holland. And it still is, actually.
Well, things are quite polarized there, right? With a lot of the farmer protests and a lot of pushback against, you know, the government, which is really closely aligned with the WEF, right? So
yeah,
Mark Rutte, I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, anyway, he's
Rutte,
the prime
Rutte,
minister.
Isn't it, I think? Yeah,
and he is like Klaus Schwab's favorite prime minister. I mean, they've made it, you know, it's not really hidden, at least in that regard. You don't have to go looking very deeply to find, you know, that association. It's like a very public one. And from what I understand, you know, this year there was like a speech that the king of the Netherlands gives or something. And for the first time, it was greeted with like lots of boos. People are very unhappy about the economic situation, the push to reduce farming and food exportation and food production really in general and all sorts of other stuff. So, you know, I guess this is, you know, important context to keep in mind when considering why perhaps they were so afraid of your father going to speak, because, you know, he's a speaker that, you know, a lot of his audience is inspired by what he says, right? And it's galvanizing. So probably concerned about that, I guess, giving more steam to the people that are increasingly against them at this point.
Also, there's a lot of people in the world in general now, I think, especially through the COVID era, but in the Netherlands they're not political necessarily. They probably thought the Great Reset was a conspiracy theory and things like that. But then they look at things like, you know, Holland is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, producer of food and exporter in the world. And now all of a sudden
Europe.
And now suddenly we're not growing food, but people are starving all over the world. And now we're, Like, we're told there's going to be food shortages, but now the government's stopping us producing food. Like, that doesn't make sense. And so in their minds, they're thinking something's up. And then obviously then my dad comes along, and, like, you know, his weekly things are called the dot connector. So he kind of takes these little dots that people think are independent of each other, puts it in the bigger picture, and then all of a sudden people go, oh my God, like, they're doing this on purpose. And they'd be terrified of people realizing that.
Yeah. So I think what's interesting is that a lot of this push to really censor and even, I guess you could say, attempts to destroy people's livelihoods and careers, you know, the big targets of that in recent years, I mean, even before other people saw it affecting them, really, it was people like Alex Jones and people like your father. And, you know, maybe they weren't right about everything, right? But they were definitely right a long time ago about a lot of stuff we're seeing play out now, including this push to global governance, a push to global technocracy, and all of that. And it kind of makes you wonder, you know, why they're going so hard for them out of everyone else that they could potentially go after.
Well, the other part of it is because it's a 2-year ban, you know, what is it that they're planning in the next 2 years across Europe that they don't want someone traveling around telling people about, you know? And also the other thing is I got a message from someone a couple of days ago who is kind of inside a little bit, so knows a little bit of how it works in terms of these bans. And actually he was saying that it's your father's not banned from the EU, but actually there's a lot of different countries that use these same lists. So if you're on this ban list for the EU, then actually that will apply to almost certainly the US, almost certainly Canada, New Zealand. My dad's already banned from Australia. That was, you know, three or four years ago. And so this person was saying, like, you know, it also doesn't mean that he's not banned from non-EU countries. Obviously, there's countries in Europe that aren't in the European Union, but actually they use these same lists. So if you flew to one of these countries, you go, actually, that's not in the EU, that's fine, I'm okay to go here. You know, you would find that when you got to up to the customs gate or whatever, that you wouldn't be coming in. You know, so actually, he's basically under house arrest in the UK.
Yeah, well, I think that's a microcosm of what a lot of us are soon to face if things don't improve or aren't challenged directly with this big push to just control movements in general and eliminate long distance travel. Not that long from now, of course, not that wouldn't be applying to the elites, right? That would just be applying to the rest of us. But it's starting with people like your father, obviously, for a very particular reason, and it has to do with what he says and with speech. So I guess the question then becomes, what are the bigger implications of that, where, you know, these privileges that I guess we're all bound to lose at some point if this agenda continues to march forward, why is it being stripped from certain people first? It's because of what they're saying, right? And I think some people haven't really seen that for what it is. I was just looking at a story the other day where there's a journalist in the EU, I believe she's German, who was reporting from the Donbass in Ukraine, Alina Lipp. So she was sanctioned by Germany, and Germany made plans to prosecute her. But now it's come out that her parents' bank accounts were closed by Germany, and they've had to leave Germany because they've basically been deplatformed because of what their daughter did. And you know, again, no actual crime, just reporting that challenged Germany's foreign policy at the time as a German citizen. That's pretty terrifying. Extreme. Yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, hasn't your family been censored as a consequence of, you know, what your father does and says in a similar way? Because it's very interesting to me that they'll go after people's families, you know, far beyond just them.
Oh, massively. The kind of the weirdest one of it is, so when my dad had his PayPal taken off him, they took everyone's, like, they took the families. But what was really bizarre was they took my dad's, like, they took my mum's. So that's like my dad's ex-wife. They've been divorced for years. Like, I don't even know how many years they've been divorced for, 20 plus years. And they took hers. And, like, she would use this PayPal maybe to, like, pay for, like, foreign trips if she was going away with her friends or whatever. She's not even got the same surname, you know, obviously, because when they divorced, she went back to her maiden name. But PayPal took hers. And it just felt at the time like that's just really vindictive, like just a nasty little spoiled little brat who's been told they can't have sweets at the checkout, you know, just a little lashing out in such a strange way. And, you know, it's very strange, like, with my dad, you're right in the sense that they want to shut him up and Alex Jones up and others because of what they're saying. But I think another part of it as well is that you make examples of them, because they don't want to, in my mind anyway, I don't think they want to have to keep shutting people up, because that's, you know, a waste of their time to have to keep deleting people and banning people and punishing people for saying the wrong thing. What the ideal scenario would be was that no one would dare say the wrong thing. And so you'll find, I mean, I saw it firsthand during COVID, you know, I was getting, because I was very outspoken about it, but that's fine because I'm self-employed. I don't rely on anyone, you know, in that sense. And my family are all on board, so I'm not going to lose that. And I lost all my normie friends like 20 years ago, so I'm not worried about losing them. So I had no fear. Whereas, you know, I was getting private messages from people going, mate, I'm on the same page as you, but if I said that on my Facebook, I'd be sacked on the spot, mate. And so, you know, even then you're creating this fear. So there's other people that think, well, I think the same as David, but oh my God, yeah, well, I ain't going to say it because this bloke's banned from Europe, you know, like, and so people in the end will just shut up themselves and not dare say anything.
Right. Well, I think that's why they've shifted so much towards this financial censorship angle. Also because it, you know, if you can't use a bank account and you can't use the financial system and you haven't made plans to be independent of that, you know, they kick you off it and, you know, you won't be able to support yourself and continue what you're doing. But I mean, in some countries, this has even happened to regular people that just donated to a particular cause, like in Canada, people that donated to the trucker protest and stuff like that had their bank accounts just taken. And that was under, you know, state of emergency, you know, crisis legislation and, you know, terrorism or policies originally used for terrorism that were applied in that particular scenario. But it's not going, I mean, it's obviously not going to stop there, you know. No. And this is something that's not going to stop with, you know, people who have been outspoken for a long time, like your family, or Alex Jones, you know. I mean, who's going to be the next person that's ordered to pay $1 billion for doubting the official story about something?
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, that whole precedent thing being set with the Alex Jones, you know, within a few days, it was, you know, all of a sudden George Floyd's family are wanting to sue Kanye West for something he said. And it's kind of like, what was it, like 250 million or something they wanted? And you're like, oh, okay, right. So that precedent has been set already and it's already being used. It's absolutely ridiculous to me that kind of people don't have the foresight. Because, you know, people are so tribal. So it's kind of like, oh, I don't agree with David Icke. He's not on my side. Like, he's not in my tribe. So destroy him. Yeah, good. Ban him from everything. Destroy him. And what they don't realize is that those rules, you know, that once they're normalized, they'll come for them in the end because that's how it works. And I was talking actually a couple of days ago to Ryan Christian and we were talking about it. And what I found, I mean, I don't like reading the comments because, like I say, Twitter is a bit of a cesspit because people are faceless. You know, they'd never say it to your face ever, like,
yeah,
because they just wouldn't. But, you know, behind a screen, bang, caps lock, have that. And so I was saying to him, like, but most of these people that are going for my dad, they're all generally, not always, but mostly on the left side of politics. So their tribe is, you know, very kind of, you know, pronouns in bio, pro Ukraine and all that kind of stuff, pro masks and jabs and these kind of things, but also very pro Palestine. And you think, okay, right, well, let's think about this. This whole attack on my dad that's been going on for years incessantly in Europe, that originated because he was speaking up for Palestinians and against the state of Israel. So that's where that started. And so you go, right, no one's on point with the government and with the narrative 100% of the time. Like, you can tick all these boxes. So you go, okay, pro mask, pro jab, pro Ukraine, pro the next thing, you know, whatever. That's brilliant. Oh, did you just speak out against Israel? Because you know that's anti-Semitic. And so in the end, they'll come for them in the end, you know. And so
totally.
It's quite strange to see people not realize that actually these bars that you're celebrating being erected, you know, they're going to be keeping you in a cage at some point too.
Yeah, absolutely. So some of the recent work I've done on domestic terror policy in the U.S. is really disturbing. And this is before even they announced their now failed disinformation board and like all other sorts of stuff. But pretty early on in the administration, they were talking about pretty much that they have an umbrella policy, which is to make people trust the government more. And their way of approaching that is to censor certain people and then basically re-educate everyone else, right? And make what they call a digital literacy program. And that's part of what this disinformation board was like supposed to do. But in what, when they talk about censoring people, they basically say that anyone that creates disagreement among Americans is inciting violence and therefore can be considered a domestic violent extremist or domestic terrorist, just because people aren't agreeing with each other, which if you follow that to its logical conclusion, everyone must agree and everyone must agree with the state. And anyone that opposes what the state says about a particular event or person or country or whatever is inciting violence by inciting disagreement or challenging the government narrative, and that's basically terrorism, as this is defined. So, you know, that's why I find it really disconcerting that, you know, what we see in this recent situation with your father is that particular line. I mean, they've already said in policy documents that's the end point, and we're seeing it advance a lot. And pretty quickly, right? So the fact that counterterror officials were involved in deciding to ban your father from the European Union, I think that says a lot. And if they sent you this, you know, terrorism related document about terror level 3, and that's why he can't be there, they think that his speech that he would have given at this rally would have, you know, I guess, fomented disagreement. And you know, allegedly that is now enough for inciting violence. So I guess, you know, we're all supposed to agree with the state. And what kind of society is that?
Well, that's it. A terrifying one. And the other thing they do and they have done is kind of conflate. So to me, like, I think of violence as violence, like physical violence. That's violence. But now words are violent. So actually you can just speak, you know, so going up on a stage and saying, I don't know, say kill all Muslims. All right, well, that's inciting violence. But now inciting violence could be saying that women don't have penises. Like, because that's, you know, that's inciting violence because that's harm. That causes harm to people that believe they're a woman, even though they're not, you know, and that kind of stuff. And so in the end, everything becomes illegal.
Yeah, well, what you brought up earlier about how a lot of the efforts to like smear and get your father banned and stuff started with the government of Israel, a lot of this effort to conflate speech with violence goes back to groups like the Anti-Defamation League, for example, who are obviously connected to the state of Israel. I mean, they're basically a lobby group for the state of Israel. Their parent organization is B'nai B'rith, which I talk about a lot in the books for people that have been making their way through that, because, you know, that's basically what the Wexner Foundation came out of. And a lot of these people that are the modern day Jewish mob, like organized, an ethnic enclave of organized crime that's existed for, you know, the better part of the past 100 years. I mean, they basically fund and run the ADL. And the ADL is the group that comes out and basically says, you want to criticize these powerful people that fund us? You're an anti-Semite, you know, to basically, you know, if you want to go and say, I mean, before Jeffrey Epstein was arrested, for example, if you wanted to go and say that something bad about Epstein or something bad about Leslie Wexner, you probably would have had the ADL come at you and say you're an anti-Semite.
Yeah, exactly. These are the groups that are all affiliated. They're the ones that initiated the ban. They're the ones, they're, you know, they're so-called anti-hate groups that basically, as Dad says, they're hate groups, really, in the sense that they just want everyone to hate their target. So they pick a target, which is
Dad. Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, and then they go, right, look how evil and horrible this guy is. But what's really amazing to me is, you know, they attack Dad on based on misinformation, fake news, all that kind of stuff, right? Yet the mainstream media can say what the hell they want, like literally what they want. Yeah. So when he got banned, there was kind of radio silence for like 24 hours in the UK. And then the UK press picked it up. And the Daily Mail, which is a complete brag anyway, but the subheader right there, it said Ike claims that Jews caused the COVID pandemic. And you're like, right, he gets banned for saying that the virus doesn't exist. So how can it be created by Jewish people? And he obviously never said that. And so I went at them, was like, you know, can you provide evidence of this, please? Crickets. But it's like, but you can just say that, you know, and someone will pick that up and go, oh my God, that's disgusting. And you, but he never said it though, because it's absolute nonsense, you know. And it's the same thing where they call him, I remember one article when this was before COVID, when they were trying to get him banned from a tour that he was doing in the UK. And there was like the Center for Countering Digital Hate, Campaign Against Anti-Semitism. These groups were all combined to try and get him banned. They actually said in one of the articles that he was a Holocaust denier that claims that Jewish people were behind the Holocaust. That was one sentence. And you're like, how can both be true?
Yeah.
Where's the editor should be looking at and going, that makes literally no sense, mate. Can you go back and rewrite that, please? But they just say it and people go, oh, yeah, he is. What both of those things?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, with people like him and the same with Alex Jones, too, even though I'm not particularly a fan of Alex Jones and some of the things that he said, particularly about Muslim Americans and, you know, narratives about 9/11 and in the war on terror. I mean, there's just a lot of, people like that, you can literally say anything about them and no one in mainstream media will challenge you unless the person you're attacking legally challenges you for defamation. Like, I'm sure you or your father could probably sue the Daily Mail, right, over things that he never said and win because the UK has really strong, defamation laws. But, you know, as far as mainstream media or like a lot of how a lot of people think. And I mean, I think they're so conditioned to hearing that type of stuff about these particular people, the people that have been targeted for so long by these specific groups, that they're just willing to accept it. Like, oh yeah, I've heard them call him crazy before. Oh, this might be why he's crazy. Wow. He's really crazy, and not really look any further than that, you know? Because he's not given the same platform to challenge what people on the mainstream media say about him. Right. He's not given that opportunity to respond.
No. And that's what is so, I think, so unbelievable, really, given, you know, especially the last 3 years, particularly in the UK and I guess in America as well, with the fact that the whole pro, you know, Rona narrative and now the whole pro Ukraine narrative has had almost every single microphone available. And yet, you know, through the internet and through protests and gatherings and stuff, like, this whole kind of counter narrative has managed to get through, and people like my dad and Alex and yourself and others, the voices have managed to get through despite all the either censorship or ignorance by the mainstream is unbelievable, really. And you know, they're not happy about it, I don't think. You know, I think particularly in the UK, that, you know, the COVID stuff and the digital IDs and all the stuff that they want off the back of it would be so much further down the line if it wasn't for people like Dad and others that stood up early doors. And so I kind of think maybe it's almost like, yes, it's about silencing him. Yes, it's about setting an example to shut people up and getting them to think twice about saying anything. But also it's about, you know, what is coming in the next couple of years that they're preemptive striking, you know, so it's like going around now, right, who is going to speak out against this, right? Well, he definitely will, she probably will, he might, blah, blah, right, we'll just get rid of them now, like a preemptive strike of so-called conspiracy theorists and alternative voices before, you know, something else comes along.
Well, I said this in a recent speech. I was in the U.S. not that long ago, and I gave a speech at Children's Health Defense, and it was basically about the crisis in journalism and how there's a war on dissent that doesn't just apply to journalism or independent journalists. It applies to really everyone that uses online platforms. And near the end of that, you know, I pointed out that these people that I'm talking about in the speech, it's mostly focused on the U.S., they want to control the narrative to a degree that we have never seen. I quote in there a guy from a military contractor AI firm that targets misinformation and whatnot. And he pretty much openly says that what needs to be done is to replace, you know, all this disagreement, quote unquote, about U.S. government history and all of that with a Wikipedia style database built off of, you know, basically authored by the CIA. I mean, it's very, you know, out in the open. And so if you plan to do that, right, and your other plan is to censor all the voices that disagree with that, any sort of truth that gets through to people, you know, people at, on a visceral level, not necessarily always intellectual, sometimes yes, but not always, you know, people gravitate towards the truth. And even if you hide it from them, and that's really the only tool they have, is to offer their version of events and then censor anything that doesn't agree with that. People are able to sort of discern, not everyone, but most people are able to discern the truth at some level that's like visceral, you know, or at least that's how I feel. And so if they're so afraid of having any sort of inkling of the truth be available as, you know, this stuff really starts to advance, that, you know, they have to try and censor really in every possible way. And there is, you know, I guess some more red lines they could cross, but I mean, it would be at the risk of totally betraying who they really are to their supposed base, or at least to the you know, the group of people who are sort of in limbo, like you mentioned earlier in like Holland, like they know the narrative doesn't make sense and something's up, but they don't really know what's going on. They, you know, if they cross that red line and, for example, start disappearing people, which has happened in other places that have gone this route before, you know, they risk sort of jolting those people out of their slumber. And any other sorts of, you know, any other sort of stuff could happen once it reaches that point. The question is, are we getting close to that? What are your thoughts?
It wouldn't surprise me at all. I think previously through history, they've got away with doing stuff like that is by creating such apathy towards those people from the population. And you can see, particularly in Holland with the mainstream media, that's what they tried to do with my dad. I mean, if you'd have read those articles, you know, you'd have literally thought he was like the second coming of Adolf Hitler. You know, that was how it was sold. You know, he was evil.
Do you think that's inciting violence against him?
Well, it is, because he received death threats off the back of it. Yeah. And all those death threats were reported to Instagram, and they didn't break community guidelines, obviously. But, you know, it feels like it's probably part of it. You know, the, if you create such hatred of someone, then you're less bothered if bad things happen to them. You know, I think I saw that on firsthand on social media, and the reaction to him being banned, you know, good. So yeah, but what's he, do you know what I mean? Like you've just been conditioned to hate this person because you've read the mainstream media's version of who they are. And all of a sudden you don't care that they have all these freedoms taken away. You can give a toss because, you know, they're scumbags in your mind. And that feels like that's the kind of the way it's been set up, with this kind of tribal groupthink that we have now, where I am so ingrained, like, in the fact that I'm right, like I am right. And therefore the fact that you're saying something different to me, obviously, well, then you're wrong then. You must be, because it's not what I'm saying. And if you're wrong, well, to hell with you. You know, and we've seen that a lot. That I've never ever celebrated anyone being banned or kicked off or deplatformed or fined or whatever for what they think, even if I think they're an idiot, like, or I don't agree with what they're saying. It's like that's not how you win an argument.
Well, I think a lot of people that you're talking about that would like celebrate a ban like this and stuff, they're getting their information from what they consider to be authoritative sources, and sources that aren't authoritative, they ignore, they belittle. You know, they see as irrelevant or bad, like as conspiracy spreaders and whatnot, right? And so it's ultimately based on a deference to authority. And so if the authorities are the people, you know, trying to silence someone, and they're getting their news from all these, you know, authoritative sources tied up with that particular authority, I guess you could say it makes sense, but I think it just sort of underscores that the issue we're dealing with here is how the state is trying to control speech. And the people that I just mentioned are, you know, people whose speech is controlled by the state to a significant degree. And that's the whole basis of, you know, I support the current thing, right? Those people are doing whatever these authoritative, quote unquote, sources tell them to be concerned or outraged about. I mean, it's ultimately, for lack of a better word, it's mind control. And what I talked about in another part of my recent speech is that in order to control human behavior, you have to control how they think, right? And a lot of that is about controlling what speech they're exposed to and not exposed to, right?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, in a free society, you would be able to hear both sides, weigh up the pros and cons of both sides, what resonates with you, what makes sense given your personal life experience, and then you make your decision based on that. But, you know, if all you have is one side, then that's definitely going to shape how you perceive the world and how you perceive people around you. But I also think, you know, like the point you were saying earlier about people know when they hear the truth, I agree 100%. It resonates within people. You know, even to such a base like level that, you know, if you were in a pub and maybe, you know, there wasn't much room around, so you're like, do you mind if we just sit there, lads? And these two lads let you sit with them, and then you end up talking to them. You know when one of those lads is full of shit. Like, you just know. Like, he'll tell a story. You don't know him. You don't know whether his story is true or not, but you just know. And like, you'll go, you know, God, the guy's just absolutely full of crap, that guy was. You just know when someone's lying to you, I think, generally. And you know when something feels true to you. And so what the media and governments that fund and control the media have tried to do, particularly over the last three years, is to tell you not to believe your own eyes. Don't believe what you see. Believe what we tell you is happening.
Right.
And it worked. It worked. It actually worked for a period of time. You know, in the UK in the end, particularly in England, the English people saw through the COVID lies pretty sharpish in the end, and hence why, you know, all the restrictions had to be lifted at a point when, you know, there's still restrictions in different places all over the world. But, you know, the masks and all that stuff went in England pretty sharpish because people were like, no, this is nonsense, I'm not doing it. But at the beginning, they did. They believed what the media was telling them over what they saw with their own eyes. And I remember saying to people, you know, how many people do you know? I don't know anyone. Oh, okay. Do you know anyone that knows anyone? Well, no, I don't know anyone that knows anyone. That's weird, isn't it? That's weird, isn't it? And you'd see like the cogs would be turning in people's heads like, well, yeah, that is pretty weird, isn't it, actually? Because I know quite a lot of people and I work in a factory with a lot of people and they don't know anyone either. But the TV is telling me that, you know, everyone's dropping like flies. It doesn't make any sense. And then, you know, you realize that you're being lied to. But at the very beginning, that's what they did. And the media just said, you know what you see with your own eyes, just don't believe that. Believe me instead. And then you have New Zealand where she says the only source of truth is the government. Imagine saying
that. Yeah, she was really blatant in that regard. But I think also at the same time, you know, like the situation you were just describing, the people that trusted it first and then feel like they got burned, right? What damage has that done to their agenda? And I think it's pretty clear when you see groups like the World Economic Forum, the Biden administration, you know, governments and media outlets and think tanks like this around the world, a lot of their big focus over the past year has been, quote unquote, rebuilding trust with the public. And it doesn't really seem like it's working to a significant degree. Like in the U.S., for example, the amount of people who believe in the mainstream media is, I think, at the lowest point it's probably ever been.
I think it's about 11%, isn't it, in the U.S.?
Yeah, I can't remember exactly, but it's quite low, right? And so they have to rebuild that trust. But I think what they're trying to do too is that a lot of the people who have tried to look for an alternative narrative, they're trying to make it very difficult to find that. At least online, which is why I say a lot to people that this, you know, fight for truth or whatever you want to call it really has to go offline as well. Because these guys, the state, whatever, is focusing a lot of its attention on the online sphere of communication and weaponizing that as much as they can. And they are insistent that only their permitted version of quote unquote truth will be what's available, and people that go against that online might even be barred from the internet or worse, especially as this this push for digital ID starts to play out. I know that, you know, in the UK, right, the gospel of digital, or the evangelist of digital ID is Tony Blair, right? But in the US, they tried to pilot digital ID for a different reason than Tony Blair's sales pitch. In the US, it was first under the Obama administration, and they called it a driver's license for the internet, tying your government ID to your internet access and what you do on the internet. And I think more recently in the UK, they've made this push to tie some sort of government issued ID to your social media accounts and things like that. And it's pretty easy to see, you know, where this is going. So anyway, since brought up some of that stuff there, I'm curious about your thoughts and on a lot of these initiatives going on in the UK right now, that are targeting speech, because there's a lot of them.
There's a lot, from what I've seen. Mm-hmm. I mean, the digital ID bit, just briefly, that, I mean, Rishi Sunak, who's now the prime minister, who wasn't elected by the people.
Not even people within his own party. Yeah.
No, who's just replaced Liz Truss, who wasn't elected by anyone either. He is a big proponent of digital IDs. I think it's his father-in-law runs a company that pushes for digital IDs, produces that kind of stuff. So, you know, there's a massive push for it there. But also, like, it's really obvious to see in the UK what they do. You know who they want to be the next government very, very, very easily. Because what happens is, if they want a Tory government, which is what they've got at the minute, the media give the Tories an absolute free ride. Like, it's insane. They give them an absolute free ride, and they tend to put the leader of the opposition as a bit of an idiot. Although in this case, he is an idiot as well. But what they've done recently is they've basically pretty much destroyed the Conservative Party with infighting and this and that, and the shambles of different prime ministers. The media is massively turned on them, and now is bigging up the Labour Party, which is Keir Starmer, who is a sir, who's, you know, a member of the trilateral commission and stuff like that. So he's an insider. So they obviously want Labour as the next government, which is hilarious, because they're now marching ahead in the polls when 25 minutes ago they were unelectable. But they didn't have to get any better. They just destroyed the Tories and made them unelectable. So when you look at what the Labour Party are pushing now, they're pushing digital IDs based on to combat immigration. That's their sales pitch now, because they've looked at immigration, which in England is insane. I think it's like 1% of Albania is in England now. It's absolutely insane. The amount of people that have come over the channel in dinghies in the last 11 months is, you know, it's I think it's the same amount as like the last 3 or 4 years. It's like it's there's a massive push for it, and they're all you know, fighting age men with 100-pound trainers, so, you know, make of that what you will. And they're housing them in hotels. They're taking over hotels, very expensive 5-star hotels in some cases, and just sticking them in there while, you know, there's homeless people on the streets. It's insane what's happening. So there's, as a result of that, there's quite a lot of uproar from the general public, because it's like, this is insane. What we're doing here? So Labour, of their kind of sales pitch of how they're going to solve it is ID cards. And you're like, that's what you wanted under Blair, and it got thrown out. So you just, you know, they always come back and revisit it. They just kind of thought, we'll come back in a bit with a new excuse for.
But isn't Blair trying to make his reentry into politics? In the US, they're trying to make a third party that's like a centrist party, the third way, quote unquote, party. And Blair was, you know, one of those third way type guys in the UK, right? Do you think he'll try and interject himself?
Do you know what? He's arrogant enough to do it, and he's got such kind of little self-awareness to actually do it. But they'll struggle with him, because he is very much hated by most people on both sides, really.
And rightly so.
Yeah, for the you know, people remember the Iraq war, do you know what I mean, and the lies and all that sort of stuff. So him being behind the party would not surprise me. Although he's, you know, they're doing that anyway. I mean, they've got this, you know, Tony Blair Institute, which is kind of embedded in lots of different.
Yeah, the Institute for Global Change, it's called, right, or something like that.
Yeah. So, you know, they're embedded anyway, and that's the thing, because, you know, politicians are just frontmen anyway. So, if you want to rule a country or push a country's agenda, you don't need to be, you know, you don't need to have the face on the stamp to be able to do that, you know, you just need to have control over the person who's got the face on the stamp. And that's, you know, Blair being involved in that wouldn't shock me in the slightest, because he's like a turd that won't flush. He just won't go away the guy.
Yeah. All right. Well, if I remember correctly, the UK has been struggling with a particular bill that targets online speech. And I think when Liz Truss came in, she said she was going to alter it. Rishi Sunak has made claims that he's going to alter it. So what exactly is the issue with this bill? Why is it bad? And do you see it being passed or not?
Well, it will be passed 100%. It's just what parts of it get passed. So it's called the Online Harms Bill. And it's got lots of different parts of it, but there was actually a bit of a victory for us really in the last couple of weeks. Now, you know, as they, like we were talking with the ID cards, they'll come back and revisit it at a later date, I'm sure. But the biggest bone of contention with most people with the Online Harms Bill was the harmful but not illegal. So part of the bill was that they could basically prosecute people for not breaking the law if it was deemed harmful. And like I said earlier,
that's regards to online speech, yes, or other.
Yeah, regards to online. Regards to online speech, yeah, and you know, video platforms and everything would all come under that umbrella. And but it was so disconcertingly vague. I mean, who defines harm? You know, watching a boy band can be harmful, it would kind of very much tie into this whole kind of push with the whole transgender movement and stuff like that at the moment in the UK, which has gone crazy, because you know the Tavistock Institute, which was transitioning young kids, it was just horrendous. The, you know, the really young children, and so there was a, you know, that got closed down, and so there's been a bit of uproar against it, and people actually speaking out against that kind of treatment. And so the Online Harms Bill, if it was in place at that point with the, you know, caveat of not illegal but harmful bit, you know, those voices, you know, people would have got in trouble for saying that kind of stuff, because, you know, you can offend and harm people really easily. You know, it's not hard. You say something they don't like, then, you know, that's harm. So that bit was taken out for now, which is great. Because that, you know, that was the real dark bit of it that I think most people thought, at least, you know, if you can get prosecuted for something that they openly admit isn't a law break.
Well, the harmful but not illegal idea is just insane, because basically, okay, it's not illegal, but we're making anything we deem harmful illegal.
Yeah, exactly. Right? And like I say, like that is such a vague term, harmful. Like that you can apply that to whatever you like. You can, yeah. You know, if you're questioning Israel, well, that's making the Jewish community feel threatened, and therefore that's harmful. I mean, it's everything, like literally anything. Like I said before, like women don't have penises. Well, that's harmful to transgender women. So there you go. The police are at your door. It's extraordinary, really. But another thing in politics, actually, I don't know if you've seen it over there, but this whole Eddie Izzard thing.
The what?
So Eddie Izzard is an actor, stand-up comedian and stuff, mm-hmm. right? And he's always cross-dressed. That's always been his look. You know, he's married to a woman and stuff, but he's, you know, he's called Eddie Izzard. He's a guy, but he's always cross-dressed. And then he started sort of saying he was going into girl mode and stuff like that. And people just kind of let him get on with it. Like, whatever, that's fine. You do you, hun. You live your best life, mate. Well, now he's a woman full-time. And so he's now basically he just wears a pink beret and a floral dress and Marge Simpson makeup, and now all of a sudden he's a woman, right? But he's standing as an MP for the Labour Party in Sheffield, and he'll almost certainly win because the North tends to vote Labour anyway, even before the Conservative Party has fallen apart. So he'll almost certainly win, and he'll become a female MP. But you know he's a man, but he has been. Video going into women's bathrooms and coming in and out of women's bathrooms, like, you know, it's created like a real crazy thing around here, where people are female, you know, are like we need safe spaces, like this isn't right. And so people that have been standing up against him have been, you know, getting banned and given warnings and abused and called transphobic and all this kind of stuff. It's been real kind of surreal here to watch it. And so he was interviewed the other day, and he was they kind of said to him, you know, what do you say to women that have, you know, very real fears about, you know, biological men, you know, technically, you know, going into their spaces and whatever. And he's just like, you know, people just need to sort themselves out and get with the 21st century. It's like, that used to be called mansplaining, that. But it really is extraordinary. And for people in America, have a look at Eddie Izzard. It's because of just the absolute madness of it. And all the news, like the mainstream newspapers call Eddie her. You know, she's going to do this, she's going to do that. And you take a look and...
Well, I think even the conservative outlets in the UK have gone out of their way to be really accommodating of this stuff in particular. But I mean, it's a really complicated issue. So, I mean, you know, if you talk to some lesbians, for example, and they have an event where it's biological women who are lesbian attending and it's their safe space. And then all of a sudden, you know, a trans woman who likes women comes and tries to go to that. It's a lot of mixed feelings in that community. Are those lesbians bigots, right? Because they don't feel, you know, are they anti-trans or anti-gay when they're, I mean, it's just like a really complicated issue. And it's, they sort of just make it like only the feelings of one person in that story matter, you know?
Yeah, well, that's how it is here. I mean, there's a trans organization called Mermaids, which horrendous organization.
Well, I think they got in trouble with the NHS and they recently, I mean, they went like pretty over the line on some stuff.
Yeah. They're, you know, they're not a nice organization at all, but they're now fighting in the courts to get, there's an organization here called LGB Alliance. So obviously lesbian, gay, bisexual alliance, where they're basically, you know, trying to protect their own rights. So it's not a case of their rights are just smashed for you know, to accommodate the T, basically. And so, you know, the Mermaids charity is now going through the courts to try and get that organization's charitable status taken away and banned and all this kind of stuff. It's really become extraordinary now in the UK on that front, on that kind of whole gender thing. It's got really quite unpleasant, actually.
So do you see a point where, you know, a lot of this like cultural stuff that have become issues, you know, we've been talking mostly about like sort of political speech, I guess, today. But do you see sort of like speech about this push to alter cultural norms? Do you see that sort of getting thrown in the same, I don't know, basket, I guess, where speech is being, you know, inconvenient speech is being equated as terrorist activity?
Oh, almost certainly. I think if at any level, if you attempt to speak out against what the agenda is, then it doesn't matter whether it's a political agenda or the cultural agenda, the war on kids, the war on the elderly, or any of these things. You know, they'll go for you in the same way because it's in, you know, you pointing these things out is an inconvenience, and so they want to silence those voices. I mean, it's very strange. Like, I made a bit of a joke, like I said earlier, like how I think it's 1% of Albanian men are now in the UK, which is insane. I mean, that's absolutely insane. And it would be insane if 1% of English men were in Albania. So do you know what I mean? It's like, it's just, it's crazy anyway. I think now 1/6 of people in Britain weren't born here as well. And it's kind of like, but if this continues, like that's, it's obviously going to alter the culture of a country. Of course it would. It would be the same as if, you know, British people went and moved into Spain or wherever else, it would create a difference. So when they banned that, like I just made it a little, it was just a joke. I was just like, you know, like the EU might be smug now, but I'll just, if I want to get my dad over there, I'll just sort him out an Albanian passport and I'll stick him in a dinghy. Right. And I just thought it was kind of like a little throwaway joke, you know, oh mate, the amount of abuse I got from that, from the blue tick wokerati calling me a racist and a bigot. They were trying to get me kicked off Twitter. It's like, you know, like when someone reports your tweet, you get the email from Twitter, you know, telling you how it didn't break the guidelines or whatever. The amount of emails I was getting because people were reporting this thing, it's like, it's a joke, mate. It's literally a joke. It's kind of true, but it's a joke, you know. And so that, you know, like I say, I was called hateful and bigoted and racist just for that. And it's like, but who am I being racist against? You know, Albanians, a dinghy? Like, what? Like, what the hell? But so, you know, that then becomes hate speech. When it's just a joke.
Yeah. So, I mean, when it comes to the illegal immigration stuff, it's really hard. I mean, it's obviously I don't know. In my personal experience, as someone that's had to move, shuffle around the world a bit in the past 2 years or so, and all these different laws that have come up with COVID and not, it's like been very hard to migrate or move legally to certain countries. But those types of barriers haven't really applied to specific populations that are crossing in specific illegal ways, right? And so that makes you think, well, it seems like these governments that are allowing that, but not allowing the other type of migration, have a vested interest in that type of activity taking place. And so if you're talking about the uptick in England of these types of migrants arriving, I mean, it's pretty undeniable that the US on the southern border is having that as well. And exactly. If you look at this from the bigger context of people looking for the eradication, I guess you could say, of nationalism and moving towards a globalist paradigm, what you really have to do is you have to fundamentally alter national identity so that it's not a threat to creating a global citizen identity, which is what, you know, is sort of the underpinning of a lot of the globalism stuff going on right now. Right.
Oh, absolutely. So, England's a different place. It's a different place from when I was a kid. And yeah, you know, I'm only 40. Like, I'm not that old. I feel it. But it's a totally different place from when I was a kid. So goodness knows how different it is from when, say, my dad's mum was a kid. You know, like, that, the place has changed so much.
Yeah,
it's
also, sure.
It's an island. It's an island, too. You know, and like with the people coming over from Albania, it's like, how many countries have you got to go through before you get to England? So there's obviously a reason for it to be England, whatever that reason is. I don't know, but, you know, there's obviously a reason behind it. And you're right, you know, rules don't apply in this case. If they wanted to stop it, they could stop it in the same way that, you know, they can stop whatever other stuff they don't want. They obviously.
Yeah. I mean, just, you know, look at the US, because DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, its mandate, the reason it's supposedly been needed so badly since it was made 20 years ago, is largely about securing the border. And they have no interest in doing that. And they've made it really clear. And there's been a lot of political huffing and puffing on both sides about it, but it's the policy doesn't make a lot of sense at the end of the day. And so, you know, I'll give an example from Chile that's sort of a little removed maybe for some people that have like emotional, really strong emotions one way or the other about this issue in the US or the UK or Europe or whatever. But like in Chile, where I live, there is also a major migrant issue. And there's people that identify as left and all sorts of stuff that are concerned that Chile is not like it used to be. And they want it, you know, they are concerned that the way they identify with their, like, not necessarily nationalism, but like, you know, they like their country and they liked being Chilean. And now they feel like, you know, if you go to a bunch of cities in the north, they're not Chilean anymore. So like, for example, people that go to cities in the far north, there used to be a tourism industry there to an extent for the beaches and whatever. Now there's not, because the Chileans that would go there, they just, you know, it's not the same to them anymore. A lot of the stuff that they liked about it at the time isn't there. And like, is it, you know, if you have a particular thing you idealize from your childhood or things that you liked about your country and they disappear because a bunch of people that aren't from there have come, does that make you a racist? What about the people in the countries they're coming from? You know, for example, a lot of migrants in Europe are from Africa and Libya, and a lot, or even in the US, they're from Honduras or places where there's violence being created in their home countries a lot of times by these, you know, the Western foreign policy. They probably want their countries to have stayed the same and not been totally decimated or destroyed or attacked by these entities. So we're all sort of, you know, migrant and non-migrant, having these same types of crises within ourselves and what we long for in a national identity. It's being taken away from people on both sides. And what are we being pushed towards? But I think, you know, either one side or the other, you know, the left really only focus maybe on the migrant point of view, and then the right only focus on the non-migrant point of view. But we're all having our national identities and cultural identities taken from us right now.
Oh, exactly. And you know, when you think in terms of the cause of it being government foreign policy, it's that whole chicken and the egg thing, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? That's the intention of doing it. But you're totally right. Like, I it is a massive gray area with the whole thing. But you're right. The leftists very much have this view that every immigrant coming in is a doctor, and the far right have this view that every immigrant coming in is a suicide bomber. And neither are correct, obviously. But it's one of those things that you can't have this conversation about. And I think anything you can't have a conversation about
Well, that's why I think, you know, what we've talked about today in terms of speech is so important, because that gray area doesn't get talked about. And a lot of people who do talk about those gray areas, they either get censored or they get maligned. You know, someone who listens to your father and you compare, you know, stuff he says with stuff mainstream media says he says, I mean, it's like, really, it's like night and day. You know, there's a lot of, you know, I haven't listened to everything your father said, but like, there's a lot of nuance a lot of the time. And then it gets boiled down and simplified into something that's like so far removed from what he was actually saying, you know, and that's sort of how they characterize them. And they, I don't know. I feel like in today's world, for the powers that be, like, nuance is something they want to eliminate entirely. Yeah, or totally. Any sort of gray area or, you know, big picture stuff where we sort of realize, oh, well, we agree about a lot of base things and we can start from there and come together, you know, anything that's going to bring people together, which often seems to be in this nuanced gray area to sort of bring the two extremes to a meeting point, you know, they don't like that and they don't want it to be there and they don't want people to listen to it.
Right. So another thing they use, Whitney, I don't know if it's the same in the US, but they use it here a lot. And I heard it a lot coming out of the Dutch ban and all this sort of stuff, is it's trope and dog whistle. And so what they can do is they can accuse you of saying something you haven't actually said by saying what you said was a dog whistle for something else. And so we saw it a lot here with the term globalist. Like, globalist is a dog whistle for Jewish now, right? And it's like, well, no, it's really not. It's a well-used term, and there are globalists there. There's people that describe themselves as globalists. But that's something they've done here in a way to silence people. So when you can say, oh, you know, globalists want to do this, and then they call you anti-Semitic, and you go, whoa, what's anti-Semitic about that? Like, what are you talking about? Oh, globalist is a dog whistle for, oh, right, okay. So what you're doing is you're accusing me of saying something I didn't actually say by using the term dog whistle or trope before it. And they do that a hell of a lot in Europe.
Yeah, I mean, it's really complicated. And I think people are increasingly getting wise to it, in the sense that trust in a lot of the organizations and outlets that push that type of rhetoric. I mean, they've kind of lost the plot with a lot of people. And, you know, I said this during the time during COVID stuff, I think they were overplaying their hand a lot. And a lot of this stuff about, like, the unvaccinated need to be wiped off the face of the earth, you know, that kind of rhetoric when it came out. And now they're trying to ask for amnesty and all that stuff. Like, they're basically acting like, you know, oh, we didn't mean to. And like, they're acknowledging there wasn't justification at all for that type of rhetoric and that it was bad and hateful. Right. Yeah. So I don't know. Will it keep working? Will it make people that previously didn't question this stuff question it? I think more people are questioning now than ever. The question is, how fast are they going to drop the censorship hammer and under what metrics? And as we're seeing in the case, of your father, David Icke, and other people, they're increasingly linking their censorship efforts with their alleged counterterrorism efforts. Yeah. But ultimately, people that challenge their authority, to them, are the terrorists. And it doesn't matter if you're, you know, someone in Iraq fighting the U.S. military occupation, or you're someone in the U.S. or the U.K. online trying to call or hold the government to account for wrongdoing. You know, it's all the same in their eyes, I think, at the end of the day.
100%. But they're overcooking the eggs. Like you said, like, they overplayed their hand during COVID. One thing about that amnesty thing, which is really frustrating, is lots of people have come out sort of asking for forgiveness based on the fact that, oh, you know, we vilified these people because we thought it stopped transmission, and now we know it doesn't. I'm sorry. It's like, oh, so it would still be okay to vilify them if you believed it did stop transmission. Okay, well, that's not really an apology then. But in terms of that kind of, you know, link with terrorism and all that sort of stuff, I just feel like they've really overplayed their hand, and they've just woken more people up. Like, they've had to now try and take the, like, Bol, which is bol.com, which is the biggest book retailer in Holland, has now banned Dad's books because they were flying off the shelves, because people are like wanting to, you know, find out what the hell this guy is saying. Because you've banned him from a continent, so he must be saying something. So books were flying off the shelves, and obviously now that they're refusing to stop them. But you know, you could have shut down that protest in Amsterdam. You could have shut it down. Say it was a security risk. Say you'd had a bomb threat you know, there was so much rhetoric in the media about my dad that people, like I said, there were death threats on Insta. Say that you had a very real bomb threat and so you shut off the whole area and you stop it. You could have quite easily done that. And it wouldn't have alerted anyone to anything, really. I mean, we'd have gone, yeah, right. But, you know, most people in Holland would have gone, oh, right, okay, fair enough. He doesn't get to speak. But instead, you ban him from the whole EU for 2 years. Like, that's going to wake people up. With Alex Jones, you could have destroyed InfoWars and shut down Alex Jones by fining him, what, like 10 million quid, maybe? You could have shut... And a lot of people would have gone, yeah, damn straight. But a billion, now all of people go, well, hang on, like... You know, like there's an organization, an American, I think, company that you know, spilt a bunch of stuff in the water in India that killed like 15,000 people. They didn't get fined half of what Alex Jones was fined for saying words. And so
Wall Street, you know, banks collapsed the economy of like the world, and they weren't even investigated by the government, and they didn't have to pay anything. Right.
There you go. So that makes
the Bush administration kill a million Iraqis. George W. Bush is celebrated as a great painter now. I mean, it's like clown world. Sure.
Yeah, but it's woken people up, I think, because people, like I say, I kept seeing it all the time. David Icke's an arsehole, but David Icke's a nutter, but. I mean, these are not people that like our family, but are saying, but this is insane. What do you mean? Like, you're banned from a continent. Like, that's insane.
Yeah, I mean, it's next level. Well, hopefully it will get better before it gets worse, but maybe not.
We'll see what happens.
Oh, sorry, what's that?
I was going to say, the more they do it, the more they show their hand, though. You know, and that kind of fills me with a bit of optimism, because I think, you know, I don't think that they want to show their hand, because no one wants to show their hand. If they could just carry on doing stuff in the background, that would be great. But the fact they're having to show their hand, to me at least, shows that they're frightened of something. You know, if I'm in a boxing match and, you know, the only time I'm going to start throwing like crazy haymakers is if I know I'm down on points. Otherwise, I'm just going to keep jabbing away, doing what I'm doing, you know. So the fact that they're flailing so aggressively at the minute says to me,
well, that's why I think possibly if they feel like they can't control the narrative anymore, they just might shut down the internet or shut down a lot of stuff. And so when talking about solutions for this stuff, I really think, you know, a lot of people talk about getting local, and I think that's important too, but you know, it may be time to take as much if you can of this type of information offline to your community, or even people that have resources and want to make imprint publications. I mean, that's all stuff to think about right now, because that's, 100%. You know, a lot of their censorship efforts are being focused on the people producing the content they don't like, and on controlling online speech, not so much in print speech. That's like, you know, printed by regular people or stuff like that. You know, the focus isn't there. So, I mean, there are things we can do to help sort this out. Do you have any ideas of your own you'd like to add? Or
well, that's happening a lot round where I live. So I live in the center of England, in Derbyshire. It's very rural. And these people are organizing together. And, you know, they're taking over farms, and they're growing their own food and this kind of stuff. There's a lady who lives here who was on a TV show called Dragon's Den. So she's worth a few million quid, which she made from some kind of some inventions and stuff, but she's very switched on. Her name's Rachel, and so she you know, took over this farm, and you know, they're growing all this food, and they're just kind of, you know, and it was funny because she had to defend herself, bearing in mind, you know, food scarcity is obviously a very real thing. We're being told about it all the time. And so she had to defend herself to the Derbyshire Evening Telegraph, the fact that she wasn't part of some end of world cult. It's like, no, she's just growing food for people that are hungry. That's a good thing. But
that, you know, that's mental, that you'd be like accused of building a cult just because you want to grow food.
Exactly. But at a time when the media is telling you this, you know, food shortages, but there you go. But so that's happening. I spoke actually at an organization that she was at, that actually a couple of weeks ago, in a place called Buxton, and it was amazing. The number of people, all different ages, all very switched on, and they're doing all their own thing. And you're right, there's a lot of, you know, having gigged in bands for years, you know, you used flyers to try and get people to your show, and then it all went on the internet. So you pied off, you didn't have to print flyers anymore. It all went on the internet. And now all of a sudden flyers are back, because you can't censor that. It's in your hand. And so, you know, there's a lot of that going on. There's a newspaper in England called The Light Paper, which I think spread to Ireland as well now.
It's in Wales also. I saw it when I was there.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, so that's getting bigger and bigger and bigger because, again, you can't censor that. It's in my hand, like, short of coming out.
Yeah, I wish more people in the U.S. would take cues from that because I think in some places they're doing it, but also the U.S. is a lot bigger than Britain, so a lot more people, I guess, would have to do it to have it pop up all over the place. But I'm glad it's happening where you are, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you do find it everywhere as well. Like, you know, you'll go into, you know, a waiting room at a garage and, like, there's, like, the big pile of, oh, man, there's a light paper there. Like, in areas that you didn't expect. So it's, you know, it's definitely getting out there. Because, you know, people now know that they've been lied to and they're starting to realize that actually those crazy tinfoil hat, weirdo, dangerous, hateful figures that told us that they were lying to us were right. Well, what else are they right about? And so, you know, people are starting to kind of be interested in what we're, you know, saying. And that's probably why the hammer's coming down a bit more now, you know?
Yeah, that could be. Well, we're about out of time here, Gareth. It was great talking to you. Thanks for sharing your and your family's recent experience and all the craziness going on in the world and in your guys' life. So where can people follow and support your work?
I'm still on Twitter for now, but it's always for now because, you know, I don't believe
Elon Musk can relate
at all. Which is funny because I appealed Dad's suspension based on the fact that, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound, if he's really pushing free speech as his sales pitch, he's got to at least try and do it for a bit, you know, even though I believe he's a fraud. And I received an email back saying that Dad's account will never, ever be lifted. So, okay, we're about free speech then. That's cool. Especially when he was banned for medical misinformation, which is since shown to be true. But there you go. But so I'm on there. I'm on Getter because, you know, Getter seems pretty decent. In that sense, I can say what I want and I don't, you know, it's free speech. And then iconic.com, obviously, where, you know, you come on our show sometimes, which is always a real privilege for us. And, you know, there's lots of different series and current affairs shows and documentaries and films and the like on there. And there's also a 7-day free trial at all times. So come and check it out.
All right. Super. Well, again, thanks for coming on. Thanks to everyone who tuned in to this episode. Sorry about the couple week hiatus. I did try and let people know that was going to be the case in the last newsletter or a couple newsletters ago that came out, but I was in the U.S. for 2 weeks. I did some interviews that you may or may not have seen that were in studio. I went to the Children's Health Defense Conference, gave a speech there, and did some other stuff while I was in the U.S. for the first time in like 8 years. So I just got back a couple days ago. So hopefully more content will be coming out from me and from Unlimited Hangout in the coming weeks. So again, sorry for that pause there and thanks for your patience. And thank you so much to all of the Unlimited Hangout subscribers that make my work and this podcast possible. And yeah, that's it for now. Catch you all next time.